From muddy jungle paths to snowy trails to rolling sand dunes, the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder is ready to take you to some of the most phenomenal destinations on Earth. In a Pathfinder, it's more than just the arrival. The real excitement comes from the ride to get there. With 7 drive modes, Pathfinder's available intelligent 4-wheel drive is built for some of the most epic journeys. So chase bigger, better, more exciting adventures in the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. Intelligent 4-wheel drive cannot prevent collisions or provide enhanced traction in all conditions. Always monitor traffic and weather conditions.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. What happens when ordinary people in real-life murder clubs set out to investigate crimes, both recent and cold cases? The Netflix hit Don't Fuck with Cats was based on the 2012 Montreal murder of 33-year-old Lin Jun by his porn star boyfriend Luca Magnotta. Previously, Magnotta had anonymously posted videos of himself killing kittens. This spurred horrified Facebook sleuths into working tirelessly to uncover his identity and location. Other investigations include a self-taught forensic artist who uses computer software and coroner's photographs to help identify victims by showing how they looked when alive. The mother who swore at her murdered daughter's graveside that she would get the gang who had sprayed her car with bullets. It took 14 years in the case of one gang member, but she finally entrapped him via the fake profile she created on MySpace. The retail clerk turned citizen sleuth who helped to match a photo of a missing man to a skull found in a bucket, which resulted in the conviction of the victim's best friend. Web sleuths matched the IP address of a suspicious contributor to a lottery-winning victim's financial advisor, which led to his body being found beneath a newly poured concrete slab in his advisor's boyfriend's garden. Sometimes citizen sleuthing goes wrong, though, with innocent people being targeted or accused of crimes they haven't committed with tragic results. The real-life version of Richard Osman's The Thursday Murder Club is grittier, with intrepid amateur investigators delving into truly gruesome, unsolved crimes in pursuit of justice. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Real-Life Murder Clubs, Citizens Solving True Crimes, with my special guest, journalist and author, Nicola Stowe. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Nicola Stowe.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, and congratulations on this extraordinary book.
Oh, thanks, Dan.
Now, let's first talk about, because I wasn't familiar with the name Richard Osman. Tell us who Richard Osman is, and what is the Thursday Murder Club? And you were asked to write this book, and so what were you surprised with in this regard with the Thursday Murder Club and your real-life murder club book?
So I was asked to write this book, obviously, by Adlib Publishers. The idea being Richard Osman is a TV presenter who had a wonderful selling book out novel called The Thursday Murder Club, which is about a group of pensioners living like it's in a retirement village, and there's a murder, and they set about trying to solve the crime, and they have a Thursday murder club where they all group together. So the idea behind the real life murder clubs, citizens solving true crimes, was to find the real life citizen sleuths, people that actually spend their time, like their spare time around jobs, searching the internet and trying to identify bodies and solve cold cases.
So what did you find from the fictitious murder clubs with this group of people that was surprising in the very beginning of this investigation into real life citizens solving crimes?
Yeah, it was a lot grittier, I must say. It wasn't like cozy like it's portrayed in the novel, but then that's, you know, that's a novel. And these people are serious, they're tenacious and dedicated. What I found particularly poignant was how the sleuths got into doing this. They all often had personal reasons for doing so, like Belinda Lane, that we're going to be speaking about, her daughter was shot and killed. And so that inspired her to go on a decade-long mission to find her daughter's killers.
Now, you say that you were hugely impressed by the sleuths' skills and impressed by their skills and vast forensic knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And you've spoke to many of these people. Now let's introduce these citizen sleuths via the contents of this book. You have the first chapter is, why did you kill her? And so we just mentioned, you alluded to Belinda and the crime of her daughter, Crystal, being shot.
Yes, that's right. So that's the first chapter in the book. Yeah, I found this really poignant, and it was incredible, the investigation she did.
Tell us about Crystal Theobald and March 8, 2006 in Riverside, California.
Yeah, so Crystal Theobald was a mother of two. She had two young daughters and a trainee nurse. One day she's with her mum, Belinda Lane, and her brother and their friend, Juan Patlin. They decided one evening to go to the 7-Eleven. It was just sort of a 5-minute drive away in Riverside. So they left. Belinda went in her own car, and Crystal, brother Justin, and Juan were in another car following, and there was three of them. There's three seats in the front, and Crystal's in the middle. Juan was driving. Belinda gets to the intersection, and all of a sudden, a white Ford Expedition SUV comes screeching around the corner, causing her to swerve and stop. She then sees a guy that looks youngish, a baby face, she called him, possibly Hispanic, who gets out the SUV and holds a gun. He pulls the gun out. And goes to, she ducks down in the car thinking he's going to shoot her. But then she just hears this explosion of glass and that five bullets exploding. When she looks up, the SUV sped off, and the car that her daughter's in goes off down the road. She tries to follow, loses them. And to cut that part of the story short, she ends up going back home, and the police are already there. Her son comes running up the street, her son Nicholas, saying Crystal's been shot. So, Crystal ended up on a life support machine. And sadly, the medics said her brain had died, and Belinda had to make that awful decision that no mother should have to make, to tell them to turn the machine off. Crystal died in Belinda's arms in the hospital, and she made a vow to her daughter, I'm going to get the people that killed you, and I'm going to make them pay. So that was what she set about doing. And then she set up with her niece, Jamie. She was just 14 at the time. They set up a MySpace account. Initially, there's a girl called Rachel, and they found members of the 5150 gang who they suspected was behind the shooting. And there'd been a rumor that they were looking for a member of a rival gang who was threatening to kill one of their members. And they were allegedly in a similar car to what Crystal and Julio and Justin were in.
Yeah, so what happens is that she does, along with her nephew or niece, set up this predecessor to Facebook, MySpace,
yes,
and set up this profile, attracting these 5150 members, gang members, to be attracted to this profile and this fake profile and photo.
That's right.
But Belinda, being who she is, she gets sort of impatient and somehow decides to post her daughter Crystal's photo on another profile and then approach these 5150. And also there's an interaction with a detective as well. Tell us the lengths that she goes to be able to pursue this person that she believes is driving the vehicle in which the killer's shot. her daughter?
Yeah, so she knew that, obviously suspected that this gang was behind the shooting and it's, you know, a mistake. So she finds a name for the person she believes to be the getaway driver, who was William, known as Joe Sotelo. And she basically, under this profile, that they used Crystal's picture and called her Angel. And she starts befriending this William Sotelo. And the dialogue continues. And she's getting angrier and angrier because she went to Detective Rick Wheeler, who was investigating the case. And they did get Sotelo in for questioning after he admitted that he drove a Ford Expedition white SUV. So he was called in for questioning, but they didn't have enough evidence. So they had to let him go. So Belinda continued, and it's becoming even more frustrating, obviously. She even got to the point where, you know, it became like justice and revenge became quite blurred. And she had a gun, and she even set up a party called the End of Life Party on the 6th of the 6th, 2006. And she was going to lure Sotelo and other gang members to this remote location, the idea being to kill them.
Right.
But luckily, that didn't happen. And eventually, like, everything just before that party was due to happen, but didn't, she confronted Sotelo on MySpace.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's where she basically said, "Do you know who you're talking to? You know, I'm Crystal Theobald. You murdered me. Why did you kill me?" And he like didn't respond to that. And then he disappeared.
Right. When he had originally spoken to police, though, he had incriminated this Julio Heredia. And so the police were working with that lead unbeknownst to Belinda. And she had confronted this Sotelo and he went on the run.
That's right.
She had contacted this Detective Wheeler and he had basically at one point told her to back off. But anyway, she continued to work and continued to look for this Sotelo as well.
Yeah, that's correct. And Heredia was the actual gunman and he actually got life in prison without parole in 2011. But that happened later after he got life. The death penalty was, Belinda did fight for that at the time and then changed her mind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But then she, Sotelo, went on the run, as you say. And it wasn't until 2014 when she had a breakthrough. She'd by this point handed the MySpace account back to Detective Wheeler.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, identified two other gang members who were brothers William and Manuel Lemus. They actually gave information on Heredia about the gunman for immunity, and then Heredia was jailed. But the 2014 breakthrough came when Belinda was searching on Facebook because she was still looking for Sotelo, and she was searching on Facebook and found a profile of him. He was using Crystal's picture but had using a different name. So she went to Detective Wheeler with this information, but he said like, he's in Mexico, but he said we can't do anything without an address for him. And anyway, she managed to get an address through somebody that she met on this profile, and they captured him in Mexico in 2016. And this led to him. He pleaded guilty to voluntary manslaughter and gang and firearms charges in like a plea bargaining with prosecutors, and was sentenced to life without parole.
Right. And very interesting, too, that two people were given life sentences with no parole. And this person that she stalked right to the end, the driver, got 22 years. So she was very, very successful in her sleuthing.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. She was, you know, she never wanted to give up. She admits become quite dangerous. She scared herself, you know, when she was trying to lure them earlier on in the investigation. But no, and she now helps like other people. She's got a Facebook group. So, yeah, I reckon she'll go on to maybe get some results in other cases, hopefully.
In the contents, your next chapter is the world's first cyber sleuth. And you cite Kerryville, Campbell County, Tennessee, autumn 2009. And Todd Matthews is citizen sleuth. Just briefly tell us a little bit about what kind of sleuthing is employed here in this citizen sleuth story.
Yeah, so Todd Matthews, he was inspired, I think, because his younger brother and sister died when they're like just like babies. He liked the fact that he could go and see like their names on the graves. But his sleuthing came about when he met who became his future wife, Laurie Riddle, and they were at school one day and they were telling like Halloween stories. And she told a story about how her dad Wilbur was found a body in a canvas tent bag. And the woman, she was like, believed to have been aged between 16 and 19, and she was completely decayed. And she was never identified, as she just became known as Tent Girl. He found her in 1968. And Todd Matthews became obsessed with this story and consumed him for over a decade. He managed to identify her eventually. But yeah, he's very much into giving people their names. He likes mysteries and finds it, you know, like some of these cases where people haven't been, like the case of Tent Girl, identified for years, but to give people back their name, it means a lot to Todd.
Absolutely. You talk about the third chapter is My First Solve.
Yes, that's Ellen Leach.
Tell us what contribution she has as a citizen sleuth.
Yeah, so Ellen Leach is, she works at Hobby Center, Hobby Lobby it's called. And she like spends like hours like checking the internet for missing people and unidentified bodies. So one evening, and her journey started really in 2004 when she was she got home from work and she's spending the night looking on the internet for clues that might match unidentified bodies to missing person cases. But she found herself drawn to a picture uploaded to the Doe Network, which is actually set up. Todd Matthews was a co-founder of. It's a list of unidentified people. And the image, this image showed a reconstruction by Jack Bender of a head that belonged to a man in his 50s who'd been murdered. And so she looked at this picture and she was drawn back to it. But she was also interested in this story about a head that had been found in a bucket outside a lorry lay-by. And she, because this reconstruction had been done, like, and the picture of the missing person she'd seen, it reminded her of this missing person she'd seen. And they managed to identify this guy that she did match them up eventually.
Yes, it's an extraordinary story. Your fourth chapter is, I'd like to discuss further because she's such an important person and well-known. And this is, the title is Web Sleuths. And
yeah,
you take us to how she became involved in being a citizen sleuth. Murray, Utah, September 1974, Trisha Griffith and the Fashion Place Mall. And Trisha Griffith is just 15 years old. Tell us how she comes to be a citizen sleuth.
Yeah, so this, when she went to the Fashion Place Mall in Utah, it was her first trip to the mall alone without her mother. And she'd given her money to buy clothes for going back to school. It was September time. So she's very excited, obviously, and she's her brother drops her off there and she walks through one of the first department stores. And then she's approached by this terribly attractive man who's just really handsome. And she described herself as being boy crazy at the time. And he approaches her and asks her for directions to a shop, ZCMI it was. And she says, no, that's not here. It's in Cottonwood Mall, which is like about a 10-minute drive away from here. So he's walking along with her, chatting to her. And she's quite taken, quite smitten by this guy because he's so handsome. And then he says, well, I've got my car. Why don't you come with me? You can direct me to the mall. So alarm bells started ringing for Trisha. And she managed to get away. Fortunately, she saw her cousin at the mall. And she phoned her brother and he came to collect her. Although he wanted to go after this guy, he brought a hammer with him. So that sort of, you know, that happened and it shook her up. But she didn't think any more of it until a few years later, when she saw an article in the newspaper, like the seven faces of Ted Bundy, and she recognised him as the guy that approached her at the mall. So she did ring law enforcement and report this, but obviously they, you know, she just felt this incredible guilt after that, because not long after Trisha's incident, Carol DeRonch was approached by Ted Bundy at the same mall.
Right.
And she posed as a police officer then, said that it was something wrong with her car, they needs to go to the police station, you know, and she probably know got her into her car and ended up like taking her to a remote spot, trying to handcuff her and threatened to blow her head off, pulled out a gun, and then she got out the car and he chased her with a crowbar, but she did get, you know, she get away, but he did get jailed for that. Yeah, so when she, you know, she just felt terribly guilty, Trisha, for not speaking up at the time. But obviously she didn't know it was Ted Bundy, so that kind of got her into sleuthing, that and the JonBenet case as well. That she, round about then, it was just the time of, you know, start of the internet, like round about 1998. So she had like an old fashioned dial up system. Yeah, but she did end up like joining. She found like this forum about JonBenet Ramsey, and she started like typing on there. And then that led her to set up forumsforjustice.org, which was, like another sort of sleuthing forum that to discredit scandalous accusations that were going on, which of course would do happen online. But then it was, so then she always had this massive interest in true crime, but the Ted Bundy situation did inspire her the most of it, something she's never forgotten. And then in 2004, she bought the Web Sleuths forum, and it's got over 200,000 members, I think, now.
And you researched and discovered what kinds of people make up this diverse group of people, and what kinds of people are on these kinds of this site in particular.
Yeah, it's a kind of mixture. I mean, some people are, like Ellen Leach, they do their day job, and this is just something that intrigues them that they do in their spare time. You know, they might not have any law enforcement background or anything like that. But you do get some retired detectives or lawyers, nurses. They had a forensic handwriting expert as a member. So yeah, but it all walks of life, really.
You also talk about another case that was really instrumental in making Web Sleuths explode, and that was Kaylee's Anthony's death. And also, you write about the Florida Sunshine Law and what that meant to a group like Web Sleuths, especially at the time of Kaylee Anthony's death and Casey Anthony being accused.
Yeah, the law means that the police have to hand over all evidence unless there's a special reason for not doing so. So they had a lot of access to records. Certainly is the case in America more so than over here anyway. So yeah, that was one of the biggest cases on Web Sleuths. Trisha said the Kaylee Anthony case. They did a ping map. They managed to prove that Anthony wasn't where she was, like this, tracking the phone calls when she said she was. They found made a search for foolproof suffocation on another search engine. It was later found out that was the case, and that evidence wasn't put forward at trial.
You write too that one of the detectives Tricia mentioned was that he had contacted Web Sleuths and thanked them for their contributions. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor. Often people wait until something bad before they consider even talking to a therapist. Therapy can dramatically change the way you look at things in your life and then find actual ways to cope effectively with those most challenging moments. At Talkspace.com, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. Talkspace can help with any specific challenges you might be facing. It's the number one online therapy platform with licensed therapists in over 40 specialties, including anxiety, depression, substance abuse, relationship issues, and much more. Talkspace is secure and private using the latest end-to-end bank-grade encryption technology to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. Talkspace is affordable and in-network with most major insurers. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $100 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to talkspace.com/truemurder. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/truemurder to get $100 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/truemurder. Now, Nicola, we were talking about Tricia Griffith and Web Sleuths, and there was another incredible case that Tricia Griffith and Web Sleuths were involved with, and that was, as you write, about Abraham Shakespeare, a 42-year-old, who had won $30 million in a Florida lottery 3 years before. Then he was reported missing November 2009, yet nobody had seen him since April of that year. As the forum's debate, you write, about Shakespeare gathered momentum, sleuthers became suspicious about a prevalent poster in the thread, one person named Doris D.D. Moore, who had befriended Abraham Moore and come into his life claiming to be an author working on a book about his rag-to-riches story and how people had taken advantage of him. And now Moore's apparently had taken over the lottery winner's assets. So tell us about Web Sleuths and what they do with this information and how they do it.
Yeah, well, Tricia became quite suspicious of this Doris D.D. Moore. She was posting, she said she seemed quite sort of flashy, show-offy person. She was claiming to be best friends with Shakespeare. She said that he'd granted her power of attorney. She'd helped him get out of town after his lottery win because, you know, he was being dumped by gold diggers, according to Moore. She was posting on Websleeves saying, "I'm taking care of his money." But as Trisha said, she seemed flashy, this woman, and she became very suspicious. So they started looking into Moore, and one member of Websleeves managed to get her bank records, I believe. And when confronted by Trisha Black, I think Trisha did contact Moore, and she denied it was her posting on Websleeves, and she said that somebody else was fraudulently using her address. So Trisha, obviously she knew Moore was lying because the IP address of D.D. Moore matched the IP address of the email that she'd sent back to Trisha.
Right.
So Trisha confronted her and she said, "Look, somebody must have broken into your house and used your computer then."
Mm-hmm.
At this point, Trisha's convinced that she's behind maybe Shakespeare's disappearance. There's more to it. So she made one exception because Websleeves is tightly moderated and she has a strict, like, no naming and shaming policy, Trisha,
yes.
But occasion she made one exception and she posted saying D.D. Moore killed Abraham Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Moore went crazy and started contesting every piece of incriminating evidence against her, basically. "I've been hacked," Moore was saying. But, you know, her actions, they just galvanised Websleeves' suspicions even more. And she was eventually exposed as a scam artist and became a person of interest when Abraham Shakespeare's body was found underneath Moore's boyfriend's concrete in the patio in Moore's boyfriend's back garden.
Mm.
He'd shot twice in the chest and buried 5 feet below a newly built patio.
Yeah.
And this was a great result for Websleeves because Moore was eventually convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison. And that's when the detective contacted Websleeves to thank them later.
You're right, though, that, and I think this is somewhat understandable, when Rolling Stone wanted to do an article on Websleeves, Florida officially, police department said, no one contacted Websleeves.
Yeah, that's what Trisha says. She said that they, which was frustrating for her because she does say that, you know, it's hard to be taken seriously at times by law enforcement. And that's one of her goals, she says, is to drag law enforcement kicking and screaming into the 21st century.
It's somewhat understandable that they just, I mean, if police forces came out of jurisdictional conflicts, never mind what they might consider non-professionals interfering, as you write, in cases or the potential for people. So I think this public acknowledgement, I don't think it will come, but a private acknowledgement, as Trisha talks about and has said to you, does occur.
Yes, that's right. I think, you know, and there have been occasions, several occasions where detectives have contacted her, I believe, and thanked her.
Absolutely. Your next chapter, you talk about the Mother Lode and Paul Haynes, a Los Angeles citizen, and his partner, Michelle McNamara. Mm-hmm. People might know who she is. Tell us just briefly about what you write is the Mother Lode and what Paul Haynes and his partner, what their goal is, their mission, and what they actually accomplish.
Yeah, so the Mother Lode refers to, it was records held at the Orange County Sheriff's Department's headquarters, and a room basically containing containers of information for the Eerons case, and the Eerons stands for East Area Rapist and Original Night Stalker.
Right.
So it was a case that had gone cold. As you know, the rapes and killings were three crime sprees, really, across California. But the case had gone cold, and Michelle McNamara, who was a crime blogger, she became obsessed with this case and felt that needed more light shone on it. So she started looking into him and writing about this attacker. And Paul Haynes joined her, basically became her lead researcher. And the pair of them together, like, spent 5 years obsessively researching these reams of data, which they managed to get because Michelle had good contacts with detectives and everything. They trusted her. So basically, they went on a mission to the Orange County Sheriff's Department. They called it a heist to get the mother load from the evidence room so they could investigate, like, all the paperwork and evidence that might have been overlooked during the investigation years before. So they managed to, so her contact there managed to sort of let them into the room, and then they transported all the documents, so it's about 37 containers, boxes, I think, altogether, into the back of their two SUVs, and they made away with it and kept Michelle's house. And then they began going through all the paperwork and trying to identify who the East Area rapist, original Night Stalker, was.
The next chapter is snaring the Golden State Killer. Again, the East Area rapist, original Night Stalker, Golden State Killer, one and the same. And how that used genetic genealogy to finally bring him to justice over 40 years later. Incredible. And to also sort of validate many of the things that Michelle had written in her book that came out just before, anyway, the outcome. Let's talk about your chapter, Forever Young, in New York, 2015, Carl Koppelman. And he creates digital illustrations of unnamed dead people.
Yes, it's incredible what Carl does. He uses a coral paintwork. It's a package. And basically, he'll work from autopsy pictures. And so people that, and then he'll create, like, find an image online of someone around about that same age, and will get, like, colours of their skin tone. And then he makes it translucent, like, sort of about 90% translucent, and then builds layers, and then gets a close resemblance to who believes that person would look like when alive. Mm. Yeah, it's really fascinating what he does.
Yes, he did a real service for the family and friends of Tammy Jo Alexander, which mm-hmm. She was called the Caledonia Jane Doe, and that she was found in a field in 1979, but not until June 2015, thanks to this person, Carl Koppelman. He was able to do this for the family and friends of Tammy Jo Alexander. Your next chapter is It Started With a Murder, and in New Jersey, and a person named Tracy Boyle, and the influence that her late father, Patrick Boyle, a detective in Pompton Lakes Police Department, was assigned the case, and the influence he had on this citizen sleuth, Tracy Boyle.
Yeah, so her father, when she grew up in Pompton Lakes in New Jersey, Tracy, and it's a small town where not much crime happened. Her dad was a police officer. And then one day a woman was bludgeoned to death in her apartment and shocked the whole community. But her dad brought home the files for this case. He was working on it. And she started, you know, having a peek at these files. And from there, she became, like, fascinated in true crime. And now she works for... Today, like, Tracy works for the DNA Doe Network, which, help, like, identify missing, but, well, people that have gone unidentified to give them back, John and Jane Doe's, to give them back their names. And so she's worked on a lot of cases.
Your next chapter is Don't Fuck With Cats. And the following chapter right after is Unmasking Luca Magnotta. As I read in the introduction, many people will be familiar with the Netflix documentary series, Don't Fuck With Cats, and its relation to Luca Magnotta, the cannibal killer from Montreal that was on the run and found in Berlin. What's interesting about this story is you just, at the very beginning of this story, Don't Fuck With Cats, is that there is a attendant at a cafe in Berlin that thinks that someone in this, that's at one of the computers booths, looks familiar. Tell us just a little bit about this harrowing scene that you write about in that chapter.
Yeah, so the guy working in the internet cafe, he sees this guy comes in, youngish, in his 20s, sunglasses, quite a nice-looking young guy, confident, and he just walks into the cafe and says, "Bonjour, internet." So he assigns this guy a booth, but there's something about him that looks familiar, you know? So Kadir, his name is the guy that works at the internet cafe. He's sort of pottering around, like emptying bins and just keeping an eye on this guy because he does look familiar, but you can't think where he's seen him. But when he's looking over his shoulder, the guy who's coming to use the internet is looking at an Interpol message about looking for Luca Magnotta, who's on the run.
Yeah.
The wanted sort of poster, you know. And then he's looking at other, like, news articles about this Luca Magnotta, who's wanted for the killing of Jun Lin, a Chinese student. When he takes a closer look at the picture, he realizes that the guy in the internet booth is Luca Magnotta. Eventually, he goes outside, and there's a a police van going by with trainees, and he managed to wave them down and they come in. If you've seen the Netflix series, you'll see there's CCTV footage of this happening, and Luca Magnotta is arrested.
Yes, and what the Netflix documentary, for those people that didn't see it, and we have to talk about it here, is that it was an army of people that were interested first in Luca Magnotta because they only knew him as this person that was posting videos of killing and torturing kittens. So, of course, people are very serious about their cats, and there are an army of citizen sleuths ready to attach themselves to some project or case. And in this particular case, there was an army of people looking for this person that ended up being Luca Magnotta.
Yeah, that's correct. It was and the two main sleuths on the series, Deanna Thompson and John, a guy that used the name, it wasn't his real name, John Green. That's how it all began in 2010. Deanna being an animal lover, when she first saw the cat video, she thought it was going to be a cute kitten video. There was two little kittens sitting side by side on a silver blanket with a picture of a wolf. And then, of course, it just gets darker and he suffocates the two kittens. So it's obviously that really disturbed her, and they started trying to find out who the person was, because more videos did follow as well. And he fed two kittens to a python, drowned another in the bath. It was horrific. But they realized that he was using like sock puppet accounts, and they really did like delve into finding out who he was, and eventually did link the guy in the video to Luca Magnotta.
Absolutely. And it's so interesting, the various, the separate skills that were employed. They were looking at the background in the video itself, items itself, trying to see any differences. And it was amazing the connections that they...
When I grow up, I'm going to be a vegetarian.
Veterinarian? It's awesome.
And I'm going to be what you said we need more of.
So you want to be a plumber-narian?
Do you think I can?
I think that if you work really hard, you can be anything.
Promise?
You bet I do.
When you promise your kids the world, we're here to help you keep it. Ohio's 529 plan is the best tax-free savings plan for future college or career training nationwide. Start now at collegeadvantage.com.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Head to White Castle for 12 crispy, all-white meat chicken rings for just $3.99. For a limited time, choose from Classic, Hidden Valley Ranch, or our new Smoky Barbecue flavor, and take home 12 chicken rings for just $3.99. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Collider says BritBox has TV everyone should be watching. Stream acclaimed series with powerful performances from Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, Bella Ramsey, and Sophie Rundle. Discover new BritBox original series like Agatha Christie's Murder is Easy, BAFTA-winning drama Time, and new crime thriller After the Flood from the producers of Happy Valley. Stream what the New York Times calls the best of British telly. Only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.
Hey parents! Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.
They made and were able to put together and really displayed the strengths of a group versus just a single person doing an investigation of this sort.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they spent hours and hours and hours. And I think the final photograph, because Magnotta used to post pictures of himself, like doctored pictures of him, like by the Eiffel Tower and mm-hmm. all these exotic locations. And I think it was John Green that first noticed that's, you know, the skin colour and his neck was different to his face, and realised that they'd edited these pictures. But the picture that they did find was him standing by a wall, University of Montreal. But they managed to go onto Google Street View, and I think it was through the traffic lights and the shape of the traffic lights in one picture, and the wall, it was like a rock wall, and they were able to find that location, which put him in Montreal.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Now, the next chapter that you have is called The Lord of Bioinformatics. And you said it in Stateville Correctional Center, Illinois, May 10th, 1994. And everybody's favorite serial killer, John Wayne Gacy, at execution.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about John Wayne Gacy's brain.
It's retained after he was given the lethal injection, because I think the idea of being there must be something abnormal there to cause him to commit these horrific crimes, but they couldn't find anything untoward. But it was, I think they do this in some cases with serial killers, that they keep the brain for scientific study.
Absolutely. They found nothing wrong. They were surprised. But the one thing that he went to his grave with was the identity of 8 bodies, 8 unidentified victims. And you're right, by 2011, with DNA advances, within weeks of them testing DNA, they had their first victim, William Bundy, a 19-year-old. Then it took 6 years later, 2017, Jimmy Hackinson. Then in 2021, Francis Wayne Alexis. I mispronounced his last name. So you spoke to a person named Kevin Lord, an engineer and genetic sleuth at the DNA Doc Project. What? Tell us about this conversation.
Yeah, so Kevin, they managed to get, obviously, like Francis Wayne Alexander, he was just known as victim number 5. He wasn't identified, obviously, for years. But Kevin works at the DNA Doe Project. So they managed to get some DNA from victim number 5's molar teeth, which they sent away for sequencing by experts. Kevin, basically, from there, he's got quite a unique role within the DNA Doe Project. I'll read you the title. He said it's Director of Lab and Agency Logistics at the DNA Doe Project. And he's basically the main point of contact with all the agencies at the beginning of an investigation. So he did the DNA sequencing based on this sample. And then they go to put this into GEDmatch. And then he was able to find relatives, which eventually led them to Francis Wayne Alexander. And he was identified as John Wayne Case's victim.
Yes, extraordinary genetic genealogy to years later identify these victims and give some solace and, again, overused cliche closure to some of these victims' families. But it is important to victims' families for this kind of somewhat closure, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, imagine people are waiting decades not knowing what happened to their loved ones, and then, you know, they finally find out the answers, and never going to bring their relative back, as it does, I think, just to see justice served as well. In many cases, it's some comfort for families.
And it is testament to how many people are involved in these groups as volunteers. They have day jobs, many people, but they are still contributing hours and hours of their valuable expertise to be able to contribute the kind of closure that I spoke to and solve some of these cold cases that are beyond the police resources, or as you see with these big groups that galvanize over a particular case, that they can be much more effective than the limited investigators and the way they have to approach a case, especially a cold case.
I admire the work they all do. You know, they do give up their spare time. DNA Doe Project, they're all volunteers. You know, it's not paid work, but they're dedicated to the cause, and it's inspirational to see.
Now, your last chapter is When Sleuthing Goes Wrong. And you said it at the Boston Sheraton Hotel, April 18, 2013, and a FBI chief, Rick Delorier, and of course, the Boston Marathon, and suspect one and two, and how the police are enlisting immediately the public to help, and the CCTV images that were captured. Tell us how all of this plays into when sleuthing goes wrong.
Yeah, so of course there was a Reddit group started, and like as soon as these pictures are out there, these Reddit users are theorizing about who these two suspects could be, and bombarding this site with comments and pictures and video footage, and basically like they're wrongly identifying people on this site, and it all went terribly wrong from there.
The one thing that police warned was that the CCTV images were the only official photos that people should use, and they were the only photos that were credible. Now, in this regard, what happened?
Yeah, well, they wrongly identified one man who was known as Blue Robe Man, and it ended up on the New York Post, basically, because one of the pictures had the guy with a bag, became known as Bag Man, and the New York Post did a story saying Bag Man fed seek these two pictures at the Boston Marathon. The real person wasn't anything to do, wasn't the suspect at all. They're just a pair of running enthusiasts who'd gone to watch the race. So yeah, it's a case of misidentification, but because of people getting overzealous on the Reddit site.
And what was, again, you use this as your last chapter, is this a cautionary story compared to the other stories where you have the moderators or the people hosting these sites saying no rumors, no naming, no shaming, but still, like Tricia Griffith, throwing out people that are troublemakers. So there is some policing of how people operate and conduct themselves on these sites. Is this a cautionary story on how things can innocently go wrong, or that it's a breakdown in how things should work on any site, especially when you're dealing with something so important as this?
Yeah, I think it's certainly very dangerous. I think it's a dangerous example of how it can go terribly wrong, you know, putting two together and five. So, yeah, I think it is a cautionary tale. And I think things have heightened up a lot since. And I think also with, you know, with online, everything being online now, and online news stories even, you know, it travels so fast. Like news, you know, all it takes is one rumour by someone, and it's somebody else that another news site has done a story on it. And yeah, and it results can be devastating, especially for innocent people.
And especially when you see that once a person has been accused, whether there is retraction, it seems to not be benefit of this person, and the damage has certainly been done by that time.
Yeah, I mean, it's still out there, isn't it? I mean, all you have to do is look on Google and it's there. So it doesn't go away just because it might have been taken down from one site. The damage has been done, as you say, to that family already. You know, it was there.
In doing the research for this book, tell us just how interesting it was speaking to these real life citizen sleuths.
Yeah, it was fascinating. As I say in the introduction, as a journalist myself, it was interesting to hear about the methods they use and the, you know, the systems and the lengths they go to try to like gather evidence and ultimately solve crimes or give names to people. I just love that they're all so passionate about what they did as well, which was really lovely. And it was interesting to see that most of the stories, obviously, apart from Luca Magnotta, were in America. Over here, it doesn't seem such a big thing, maybe because we don't have access to as many records as you do over there. So that was interesting. When I was trying to find interviewees, I did struggle to find anyone in the UK. It was all mainly people in America. And they were all so generous with their time and forthcoming. So it was a brilliant experience. I just got a lovely message from Belinda Lane yesterday saying how much she enjoyed the book. So that's always heartwarming when people do that.
Wow, that's incredible. I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about the Real Life Murder Club, Citizens Solving True Crimes. For those people that might want to take a look, do you have a website or do any social media?
Yeah, my website's just nicolastowe.co.uk and at Nick Writer on Twitter.
I want to thank you very much, Nicola Stowe, the Real Life Murder Club, Citizens Solving True Crimes. Thank you very much for this interview, and you have a great evening and good night.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Dan.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, Kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.